or this way? How do I please thee? Am I the gay shepherd bird in the many-colored coat? Mommy's raiment? How doth it become her son? He looked, of course, like a young god. The effect he produced was only to be expected, and his eagerness to bring it about did anything but strengthen Jacob's resistance. We shall do well to recognize at once the irresistible guile by which he had finessed the garment out of Jacob's hands into his own. And this was scarcely done when the thing was on his back, put there by two or three deft and assured motions, which themselves evinced great skill in the art of dressing. How well it set him off! It covered his head and wrapped his shoulders. The silver doves glittered, and the gay embroideries glowed. It fell in folds about his youthful form, and made him look taller than he really was. But not only so, for the festal garment became his face to such an extent that nobody who saw him could have disputed the popular verdict upon his charms. It made him so lovely and so well favored that the phenomenon was actually no longer quite earthly. In fact, it bordered on the supernatural. Worst of all, the likeness to his mother, her look, her forehead and brows, the shape of her mouth, had never stood out so clearly as in this dress. Poor Jacob was so smitten by it that his eyes overflowed, and he thought nothing else than that he was beholding Rachel in Laban's house on the day of the fulfillment. It was the mother goddess who stood there before him, smiling in the boy's lovely guise, and asked, "I have put on my coat. Shall I take it off?" "No, no, keep it, keep it," the father said. The young god rushed away. Jacob lifted his brow and his hands, and his lips moved in prayer. The nimble runner. The excitement was tremendous. The first to see Joseph in his coat of many colors was Benjamin. But Benjamin was not alone. Joseph found him in the women's tent with the concubines. He entered their quarters in his new finery and said, "Greeting to you all. I've just come by chance to look in on my little brother. Lo, thou art here, my bainey. I only wanted to ask how you all are. So, you are combing flax? And Tortura is helping? Do any of you know the whereabouts of old Eliezer?" Tortura meant little one. Joseph often called his brother by this Babylonian pet name. And Tortura was already giving vent to long-drawn-out cries of admiration. Bilhah and Zilpah chimed in. He wore his robe with a careless air, drawn up and thrust through the girdle of his smock. "What are you all chirping about and making eyes like cartwheels?" "Oh, you mean my garment, Mommy's veil katonet. I'm wearing it for a while, Israel having made me a present of it a few minutes ago." "Joseph L., thou sweetest lord, son of the favorite," cried Zilpah, "hath Jacob then given thee the coat of many colors, in which he first received Leah, my mistress? He hath done wisely and justly indeed, for the heart melteth within one at the sight, so that one could not imagine another wearing it. One of those now on a journey, perhaps, the offspring of Leah, from whom Jacob lifted it for the first time? Or my Gad, or Asher, born on Leah's lap? The very idea maketh one to smile, albeit ruefully." "Josephia, loveliest one," Bilhah cried, "nothing more beautiful can be conceived than thy looks in this robe. One is tempted to prostrate oneself at the sight, and especially I, who am only a handmaid, though sister and favorite to Rachel thy mother, to whom by the power of Jacob I bore thy elder brothers Dan and Naphtali. They too will fall down before thee, or be like to it when they see the youth in their mother's wedding garment. Go then swiftly and show thyself to them unawares, while they are yet all innocence, and dream not that our Lord hath chosen thee. Likewise thou shouldst go across the country, and show thyself to Leah's six red-eyed sons, that thou mayest hear their exulting shouts, and their hosannas may strike upon thine ear." It is almost incredible, but Joseph did not notice the thick layer of bitterness and spite which coated the women's words. His self-absorption, his blissful, though nonetheless reprehensible, self-confidence made him deaf and unresponsive to any warning. He sucked up the honey of their words, quite convinced that he deserved it all. It never occurred to him to look beneath the surface. But precisely therein lay the blame. Indifference to the inner life of other human beings, ignorance of their feelings, display an entirely warped attitude toward real life. They give rise to a certain blindness. Since the days of Adam and Eve, since the time when one became two, nobody has been able to live without wanting to put himself in his neighbor's place and explore his situation, even while trying to see it objectively. Imagination, the art of divining the emotional life of others, in other words, sympathy, is not only commendable inasmuch as it breaks down the limitations of the ego, it is always an indispensable means of self-preservation. But of these rules, Joseph knew nothing. His blissful self-confidence was like that of a spoilt child. It persuaded him, despite all evidence to the contrary, that everyone loved him, even more than themselves, and that therefore he needed to take no thought of them. To pardon such conduct as his on the score of his beautiful eyes would be weakness indeed. But with Benjamin, the thing was different. Here, for once, complete wholeheartedness was in place. He cried out, "Jehoseph, thou heavenly one, not as in our waking life, but as in a dream, it seemeth, and the Lord hath wrapped thee in a garment of splendor, woven full of colored lights, and hath put upon thee a mantle full of pride and glory. It must ravish the soul of a little urchin like me. Go not, I pray thee, to the sons of Bilhah, and leave the sons of Zilpah yet in ignorance a little. Stay by thy little brother, that I may admire thee the more, and look my fill." All that Joseph might take at its face value. It rang true. Even so, he might draw a warning from his little brother's simple words, for we cannot help feeling that Benjamin was afraid of the meeting of the brothers, and wanted at least to delay it. Joseph himself possessed enough instinct, if not enough insight, not to appear straightway before the children of the maids in his new garment. With the exception of a few underlings who saw him in passing and outdid themselves in adulation, hand-kissings, and obvious envy, the only person who beheld him that day was Eliezer. The old man fell into a prolonged nodding, which might be taken for approval, but equally for a sort of general contemplation of mankind and his destiny. He then, with an abstracted and godlike mien, began to enlarge upon his so-called recollections, those which the sight of the garment called up in him. How, that is, he, Eliezer, had once, as wooer in Isaac's stead, brought Rebecca up out of Haran's underworld, and when they had reached the upper regions and the bridegroom was approaching, had shrouded her in the veil. And for what reason? That Isaac might know her. For how should he have known her and lifted her veil unless she had veiled herself beforehand? Eliezer's countenance, as he talked, was so unmoved that it looked like a false face, which you could perhaps take off and show another one beneath it. "A marvelous thing, my child," said he, "hath Israel given thee. For in the veil is life and death. But death is in life, and life in death. And he who hath learned this truth hath penetrated the mysteries." The sister, mother, bride, had to unveil herself and stand naked at the seventh gate of hell and in the face of death. But when she returned again to the light, she veiled herself in token of life. Lo, the seed corn, how it sinketh to earth and dieth, that it may arise again for the harvest time. For the sickle lieth already close to the blade. The sickle which waxeth in the darkness of the moon as young life, yet is it death, and taketh the manhood of the father, that it may assume new lordship over the world. And from the harvest of the sickle rolleth the fruit of life and death. Thus the veil signifieth life after the unveiling in death, and therewith already possesseth knowledge and death, since after all in knowledge is procreation and life. A great thing hath the Father given thee. He hath given light and life when he veiled thee with the veil which thy mother had to leave behind her in death. Therefore, cherish it, my child, that no one rend it from thee, and that death may not know thee. "Thanks, Eliezer," answered Joseph. "Many thanks, wise old servant, who in Abram's train struck down the kings and toward whom the earth did spring. How weightily thou speakest of all these mingled things, of veil and sickle and seed-corn. Rightly, too, since these things are related and are one in God, though to our eyes they are embroidered manyfold upon the veil. But now, as for me, I will take off my coat and cover me with it upon my couch, that I may sleep beneath it as sleepeth the earth beneath the world-mantle of the stars." Thus he did. And thus they found him sleeping, the children of the maids, when, instructed by their mothers, they entered the tent which he shared with them. The four brothers, Dan, Asher, Gad, and Naphtali, stood at his bedside. And the youngest, Asher, the sweet-tooth, barely 22, held the lamp to lighten his sleeping face and the gay robe that covered him. "Behold," he said, "there hast thou it. It is precisely and no other than what the women said, when they told us that the coxcomb had shown himself to them in his mother's ketonet pasim. He hath spread it out and sleepeth beneath it the sleep of the just, with a sanctimonious expression on his face. Is there any more doubt? Our father, poor man, hath given it him, beguiled thereto with honeyed words. Oh, for shame! For we feel equally angered over this abomination that hath come to pass, and it is Asher who taketh our combined anger into his mouth and spitteth it out over the head of this offence that here sleepeth. May it give him, at the very least, bad dreams." He greatly loved this Asher to be of one mind and heart with his fellows, and to strengthen his sense of unity by expressing it in words which should do full justice to the common opinion. This gave him a feeling of warmth and comfort, even in the midst of his rage, and the characteristic harmonized with his humid lips and eyes, and his love of eating. He went on, "So I have cut pieces out of live rams and sheep and eaten them, have I? He told that to our dear, good, credulous father, who then gave him the ketonet as a reward for his lying. And so with each of us. He hath charged each one of us with some fault, and now lieth there under the garment gained by his falsity and the evil reputation he hath given to us. So then, brethren, let us stick together and be of one mind in our wrath, and let me name him by some name that shall ease all our hearts, such as thou, puppy." He had wanted to call him, quite simply, "thou dog," but at the last minute a fear of Jacob made him soften the epithet. It was Dan who spoke next. He was 27, the same age as Leah's Simeon. He wore a tight-fitting, embroidered smock, had no mustaches but a pointed beard, and his prominent eyes lay close together at the root of a crooked nose. "It may be," said he, "that I am called Snake and Adder, forsooth, because I am said to be somewhat malicious. But what is that compared with him who lieth here? He is a monster in the guise of a lovely youth. Cursed be that lying shape which maketh the folk to ogle and gape and bewitcheth our father utterly. I would I knew the charm which could force him to reveal his true form." Then Gadiel took his turn, a sturdy fellow, a year older than Asher, with an expression of rude honesty. He wore a sugar-loaf cap and had a military air, due to the baldric round his short coat and the breastplates he had sewn upon it. His red and sinewy arms, with their stubby and equally sinewy hands, stuck out from the short sleeves of his coat. "Let me advise thee, Asher," he said, "to take heed to thy lamp, that thou lettest no oil drip down to awaken the sleeper with its smart, for if he awake, he shall feel my fist straightway in his jaw, and it will swell till he seem to have a lump of flour in it, and so remain till 9 days from tomorrow, as sure as my name is Gad. For I am hot with rage, and sick to death at sight of him, and of the coat beneath which he sleepeth, the price of his shameless betrayal of our father. I am no coward, but something, I know not what, rumbleth in my belly, and admonisheth me out of my entrails. Here we stand, we brethren, and there lieth he, the rascal, the coxcomb, the puppy, the turner of heads, and he hath the coat. Are we to bow down before him? I keep hearing those words, bow down, as though some cursed insect kept buzzing them in mine ear. Therefore it is that my hand itcheth to be at his ear. That would be the right treatment for him, and would satisfy the hatred in my belly. The straightforward Gad had uttered much profounder things than any that Asher, despite all the latter's need to consolidate opinion and achieve unity through the spoken word, had even tried to reach. For Asher's one thought was to call out affection and produce solidarity by expressing only what was simple and easy to grasp. Gad took more trouble. He struggled to get at the things that tormented and frightened them all, things which lay far beneath the simple emotions of envy and rage. He wrestled to find words for obscure memories, anxieties, apprehensions, for some shadowy train of associations which should combine the essence of manifold conceptions, such as firstborn, deception, exchange, world dominion, brother vassalage, and which, while not properly recognizable as either past or future, as legend or as prediction, yet perversely evoked the words, "Bow down. They shall bow before thee." The others felt greatly, even inexplicably challenged by the power of Gad's words, especially the long, lean, stoop-shouldered Naphtali, who was already shifting from one foot to the other, so greatly had Gad's words made him tingle in all his limbs with eagerness to be off. He had the instinct of a carrier pigeon, and his calves had for long been fairly twitching and his body shaken. His imagination was completely controlled by the conceptions of space and separation. He regarded space as his most familiar enemy, and himself as the appointed means of its conquest. In other words, he felt it his mission to even out those differences in men's knowledge which were affected by distance. When anything happened in the place where he was, he immediately connected it in his mind with some distant spot where nothing of it was yet known. And to be in such a state of, so to say, vegetable unconsciousness was intolerable in Naphtali's eyes. It made him quiver with the urgency of striding out with his legs and of loosening his tongue to set things right, in order, wherever possible, to equalize the sum of man's information by spreading it from where it existed to regions still disgracefully ignorant. The place in point at present was that where the rest of the brethren were. Straightway, and before any of the others, he thought of it. They were in ignorance. They knew not, thanks to the deplorable working of space and distance. But they must learn speedily. In his mind, Naphtali was already running. "Listen and hearken, brethren, children, and friends," he began in his quick, soft voice. "We are standing here and see with our eyes what has happened. We are on the spot. But at this very moment in the Vale of Shechem, the red-eyed brothers are sitting about the fire, chatting of this and that and the other, of anything save the fact that Jacob hath exalted Joseph's head to their own undoing. For they know it not, and however loud their shame crieth aloud, theirs and ours, they hear it not. But shall we then content ourselves with the advantage we have, saying, 'They are distant, and thus foolish, for to be distant is to be foolish,' and let it go at that? No, for we must tell them, that it may be there as it is here, and that they may not go on living as though it were not. Send me, I will speak to them across country, and give them word that shall lighten their darkness and make them to shriek aloud. But to thee, hastening back again, will I announce how they shrieked." The others were of the same mind. The red-eyed brethren must hear the truth. Indeed, it almost touched them more closely than it did the present four. Naphtali knew the road. They would tell their father that he had gone on pressing business. He scarcely slept for impatience, and saddled his ass before dawn. When Joseph awaked under his world mantle, he was already far off, and knowledge well on its way to the distant brethren. 9 days later, exactly on the day of the full moon, they all returned to Hebron, together with the messenger, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, and peered dourly about them. Naphtali said that the twins, Simeon and Levi, so called because they were only a year apart, had roared like bulls on hearing the news.